From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right life. He doesn't create.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, we revisit our conversation with Breaking Bad creator Vince Gilligan as the show is in the midst of its final season.
I don't want this to be a show where people say, Breaking Bad, I used to love that. Is that damn thing still on?
But first on the Hollywood News Banter, the summer's over and awards contenders are making their bows at the fall film festivals. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I am joined by my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times, who is in Telluride for the film festival. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, it's a long haul to get to Telluride, but looking at the list of films, it seems like very rewarding, potentially.
And certainly has been in years past. I mean, it is hard to get to this mountain town in Colorado, but over the last couple of years, any number of Oscar winners have premiered here, including Slumdog Millionaire, Argo, and The King's Speech. And this year, the high-profile titles, the new movies, are 12 Years a Slave, Labor Day, Jason Reitman's new movie, Gravity with George Clooney, and then a couple of films that played in Cannes, including Robert Redford's nearly dialogue-free sailing disaster movie, All is Lost.
And Gravity just unveiled itself in Venice, that film festival also underway. We have already seen rapturous reviews for Gravity. This is Alfonso Cuarón's space thriller, I guess you could call it. And it just seems to me like a rich array of films for the true movie-loving public, not the popcorn audience, after a pretty arid summer.
I would say the summer was particularly bad, but based on what I've seen so far in Telluride, the fall is going to be fantastic.
And it's interesting, John, we're talking about this rich spread with, you know, potentially, who knows, enough movies to fill 8, 9, 10 of the Academy Award Best Picture slots and be in competition. At the same time, there's been so much talk about how the talent is really fleeing to television and particularly to cable, especially with dramas. Somehow these films got made, but Kevin Spacey, whose career, of course, spans stage, screen, large and small, gave a speech in Scotland at a television festival this past week talking about the future of this business, how important television is right now, and how people watch television on all different screens and how important it is to have creative freedom.
No, he had a great indictment of the pilot process, especially as it involved House of Cards and how no one wanted to buy the show, which has turned out to be a very good critical and commercial hit for Netflix, without a pilot, even though David Fincher was the director and Bo Willimon, who is a great playwright, were involved. Nobody wanted to take a gamble on it. But I thought what Spacey said that was most interesting, it's something that we have talked about kind of off and on, is about platforms and how the audience doesn't really care as much as they used to whether a movie was seen in a movie theater and a TV show was seen on a TV screen. And I thought the most profound things he said is that it doesn't really matter anymore, and that the difference between film and television, particularly because people watch those shows and those movies in very different ways, is blurring. And that the way the platforms are evolving is that there is hardly a distinction now between the two.
The one quibble I would say I have is that, you know, I just can't help but note that despite his talk of House of Cards and what a success it was, Netflix is not releasing any ratings. They don't release a lot of data about these things. It definitely seems to be working in branding Netflix. But I think we have to be careful about saying that something worked for them because it's really not so clear what their model is.
That's true. It does seem that it's attracting viewers and it has created a new way of programming, the binge programming, where all of the series episodes are available in one fell swoop.
And we'll post a link to that Kevin Spacey speech on our website, kcrw.com/thebusiness. Now, elsewhere on the small screen, ESPN last week dropped its association with Frontline, which is the much lauded public television, public affairs series. They were involved in a two-part documentary about concussions in the NFL. This is set for release in October. After 15 months, ESPN stripped its name, logo, and credit from the film. This project is called League of Denial, the NFL's Concussion Crisis.
No, and ESPN said publicly that it was a branding issue, but I think it's much more nefarious than that. And I think the timing is unusual. Keith Olbermann returned to ESPN recently and went on a rant about reporting being dead. Those are his words. And I think this is a huge black eye for ESPN, which for all intents and purposes is really a fan show. I mean, they claim to be journalists, but their one serious news show, Outside the Lines, was just moved off ESPN onto ESPN2 to make room for more NFL pregame show. I think there was high pressure put on, as has been reported from the NFL, not just to ESPN, but to Bob Iger, who runs Disney, which owns ESPN. The NFL is the most profitable part of ESPN's business, and ESPN makes up about half of Disney's earnings. So I think it's very obvious that the NFL said, we don't like this show. ESPN ran from it, and I think it's a huge problem for ESPN standards. I mean, I think if you're a journalist who wants to go work there, you really have second thoughts now.
Bear in mind, they paid $1.1 billion for the rights to Monday Night Football. This is not an unprecedented problem. To me, the shocker is that ESPN would agree to do this in the first place, because if you know anything about Frontline and the NFL and the concussion crisis, you would have to know that this is not going to be just a gentle kiss.
No, and I think one of the ironies is that all this controversy about ESPN pulling away from the program means that more people will watch it than ever would have in the first place.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Today we're revisiting our conversation with Breaking Bad creator Vince Gilligan. The critically acclaimed show, now in its last season, stars Bryan Cranston as a cancer-stricken chemistry teacher turned drug kingpin.
Do you know what would happen if I suddenly decided to stop going into work? A business big enough that it could be listed on the NASDAQ goes belly up. Disappears. It ceases to exist without me. No, you clearly don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Breaking Bad has won 7 Emmys and has 12 nominations this year. Now, in the latter half of its 5th and final season, the audience is just shy of 6 million viewers, 4 times the number of people who watched the 2008 series premiere. Before he created Breaking Bad, Vince Gilligan had been a writer-producer on The X-Files, and he'd written a few screenplays, including the 2008 Will Smith film Hancock. But he'd never been a showrunner. When Gilligan first pitched the idea for Breaking Bad, FX bought it. But as FX president John Landgraf said in an interview on this show, he ultimately passed. At the time, the network already had 3 series with male antiheroes: Nip Tuck, The Shield, and Rescue Me. Landgraf just couldn't pick up one more. But he told us,
if I had known that Vince Gilligan was going to be one of the best showrunners in television, and Breaking Bad was going to be literally one of the very best shows in television, I would have picked it up despite the concept.
When Gilligan spoke with the business producer Darby Maloney last year, she asked him how, on his first television series, he became a showrunner who inspired such regret in a successful programmer like John Landgraf.
I want to preface this by saying I heard what John Landgraf said, and I want to say, if I may,
sure,
that he is an absolute class act. And no one has a crystal ball in this, but I would have made the same exact call if I were in his shoes when I came to him with this show about a guy, middle-aged guy, dying of cancer, cooking meth. They had a mandate, as I understood it at the time, to get more women watching FX because they had all these antiheroes. And also they had a show in hand that had a bona fide TV star attached, Courtney Cox.
Oh,
and
Dirt.
And they only had money to do the one show. But what makes him a class act is that he let our show go. He let it be bought by AMC. He did not bury it on the off chance, as it turned out, that it would actually go on to some success and become something of a, you know, what it's become. And that is rare in this business. There's a lot of guys in his position at various networks around town who absolutely, I've had it happen myself, will not allow that. We'll just squash it, put it in a file drawer, let it collect dust, that first script, never let it go anywhere.
In going to AMC, maybe we'll stick with AMC for a second, and we'll get back to the showrunner
sure.
question, unless you
Which
you
I
feel
don't
like
know that
can...
I have a great answer for. I feel Well, I feel like I've fallen ass backward into, I always say I feel like Kramer on Seinfeld, fallen ass backward into good luck. I did not know, I can tell you this for sure, I did not know going into this job that I'd be able to pull it off. I knew I could write for television. I had 7 years on The X-Files, which was, if there was anything I can point to as to why I'm able to do this job now, it's because I had 7 years on The X-Files working for Chris Carter, who was a wonderful writer and a wonderful showrunner and a wonderful teacher. You know, I was a good number three on that show. I didn't know I could jump to number one, as it were, and be able to pull it off. I said as a joke one time on a panel, they said, what does it take to be a good showrunner? And I blurted out, you need to be a cult leader.
Mm.
And as soon as I said it, I was joking. I was trying to get a laugh out of the audience. And as soon as I said it, though, in some sense, it felt right. That sounds like a weird thing to say, but you have to, the cult, instead of the cult being about you, the cult has to be about the show. You have to be the high priest or priestess, but you have to, what's the word, inculcate? Is that the right word? You have to...
Indoctrinate.
You have to get everyone enthusiastic, everyone from your writers to your director of photography to your cast, absolutely your cast, every department head, every member of the crew, all your producers, you have to get everybody pulling the rope in the same direction. And in that sense, you have to be something of a cult leader, you know, or a cheerleader, or whatever. Cheerleader is probably a more palatable term than cult leader.
Well, I don't know. Breaking Bad's pretty dark, I think.
But you got to get everybody saying, my God, I'll bleed for this show.
If you're just joining us, I'm Kim Masters, and we're talking with Vince Gilligan, the creator of Breaking Bad. The much-lauded show is in season 5 and headed toward its final episode. After season 4, Sony Pictures Television, which produces the show, engaged in heated negotiations with cable channel AMC over the number of episodes that Breaking Bad would have to wrap up its run. The previous year, AMC had done some high-profile bargaining with Mad Men creator Matt Weiner over the budget for that show. In her conversation with Gilligan, the business producer Darby Maloney noted that some observers thought AMC had made such big concessions to Weiner that the network then put the squeeze on Breaking Bad.
I'm not trying to bait you with Matthew Weiner here, but what do you make of that? It's out there in the public dialogue around the show.
Yeah, I would have had to have been deaf, dumb, and blind not to have heard all those accusations bandied about. From where I was sitting, I don't now, and nor did I then, see any truth to them. As to the question of Breaking Bad is getting short shrifted because of Mad Men, because Mad Men cost so much or whatever. The simple truth of it, it seems to me, is that Mad Men is a much more palatable show to advertisers. I've heard it described as a love letter to advertisers. It's obviously much, much more than that. It's a brilliant show, one of the very best written ever on television, and I enjoy it. I've seen every episode, and I enjoy it immensely. But it is also a show. I don't know if Matt was thinking of this he probably was not. He just wanted to tell a good story. But I'm sure he's very happy that it's a show that advertisers love, because when advertisers love your show, you are golden. If advertisers truly love your show, it doesn't even matter if anyone's even watching it, just as long as advertisers want to put their name to it by paying for those 30-second spots. Breaking Bad is not an advertiser's dream of a show. The meth content, then the criminal. It's not even the criminal stuff. I think it's the specificity of the crime. The meth is not sexy. It is not in any way, shape, or form the kind of thing that a lot of big companies want to have their name attached to. I think that ice, that particular ice, has been melting in the last 4 years, and we have more top drawer advertisers than we used to. But I think what it came down to last season was not that Matt Weiner's deal took money away from Breaking Bad. It was simply a matter of, is Breaking Bad the right place for a growing network to be spending its money when money could perhaps be better spent on other projects? And there was a time there when indeed probably Sony wanted more episodes than AMC wanted.
How many episodes did you want, though?
I got to tell you, we wound up with the right number of episodes. I couldn't be happier. I think 16 episodes is the perfect number. And when I say that, I want folks to understand, I don't want this show to end, because it is the most satisfying thing I've ever done. It's the best group of people I've ever worked with. It's the most creatively satisfying thing I've ever done. I fear it will be the most creatively satisfying thing I will ever do. But all good things must come to an end. And I don't want this show going past its height, its creative height. I don't want this thing to peter out. I don't want to start treading water creatively. I don't want this to be a show where people say, Breaking Bad, I used to love that. Is that damn thing still on? Wow, I didn't know that was still on. That's the worst outcome I could think of. I would rather leave people wanting more. And to that end, 16, because this is a story about transformation and change, because the idea here is to take the good guy protagonist, turn him, he turns himself, in fact, by force of will, into the bad guy. There's only so bad this guy can get. And then basically we made our point, and it's time to turn off the lights.
So you spend most of your time in the writer's room.
Yeah.
How much are you dealing with the budget side of things?
As little as possible.
Yeah.
I look at these spreadsheets and these budget documents and whatnot. I don't pretend to understand all the money into things that well, but they tell me if we can't afford
but
it.
But sometimes the budget does dictate what you can write and what you can shoot,
absolutely.
Obviously. So can you give an example of something that had to change in a plot because of budget reasons?
Yeah. Like a good example, for instance, is we had an episode back in season 2 in which Jesse Pinkman's character sneaks into a junkyard. Basically, behind this tall chain link fence resided the RV.
Right, that, the mobile meth lab.
The mobile meth lab. And poor Jesse in this particular episode had lost his home, had nowhere to go. He was going to sleep in the RV because that's all he had left. He was going to climb this tall fence and get into this yard, but unbeknownst to him, there's this junkyard dog who's going to chase him and, you know, rip the seat of his pants and then keep him hostage in the mobile meth lab all night long. And it was a fun scene. My writer, Sam Catlin, did a great job writing it. And when it came time to shoot it, Stu Lyons, our physical producer, said, you know, the dog's going to cost $25,000.
Wow.
And I said, well, why the hell does a dog cost $25,000? Well, we're in Albuquerque. There's no dog trainer out here, a Hollywood-type dog trainer. We're going to have to fly a guy in from L.A.,
mm-hmm.
And he's going to need two dogs. He's going to need time to train both of them. You need a backup in case the one doesn't feel like working that night.
Right.
And I said, okay, well, whatever. And then he said, yeah, but we don't have an extra. We're way over on this one. We can't do it. So then Sam, the writer, and I are racking our brain, along with the director, John Dahl, did an excellent job on that episode. And we're standing there at the location racking our brains, and we look across the street, and there are literally 500 porta-johns across the street because apparently the city of Albuquerque stores them there in a field. So we quickly, Sam and I, came up with this idea of Jesse instead climbs the fence. There's a porta-john right on the other side of the fence, and he climbs on top of it because there's barbed wire on the top. It's easier to climb onto this thing. And as he stands on the roof of the porta-john, it collapses beneath his weight, and he winds up with all this terrible blue chemical nastiness all over him. And my point being, this limitation worked to the good because everyone's seen a junkyard dog scene. Everyone's seen a guy get the seat of his pants ripped out by a junkyard dog. I feel lucky that the budget limitation made us try a little harder because that scene is more indelible than a dog chasing a guy. Your poor guy covered with blue gunk and sobbing, you know, in a fetal position in a meth lab, you know.
Completely humiliating.
Yeah.
I mean, if he hadn't been humiliated enough already. And obviously, it cost a lot less money.
That cost a little over $5,000, buying a used porta-john, steam cleaning it out, rigging it with some less than nasty fake blue chemicals and rigging the roof and getting the stuntman to fall through the roof and whatnot. It was substantially cheaper. Yeah.
Coming up after a short break, Vince Gilligan fears binge viewing could hurt the TV business. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Today, we're revisiting our conversation with Vince Gilligan, creator and showrunner of Breaking Bad, which is in the midst of its final season. The show stars Bryan Cranston as a teacher-turned-meth cook and Aaron Paul as his one-time student-turned-business partner.
We're talking 200-300 boxes of sinus pills. There ain't that many Smurfs in the world.
We're not going to need pseudoephedrine. We're going to make phenylacetone in a tube furnace. Then we're going to use reductive amination to yield methamphetamine, 4 pounds.
So no pseudo?
No pseudo.
So you do have a plan. Yeah, Mr. White! Yes, science!
Okay.
Breaking Bad has its share of graphic imagery, from the grim environment of a meth den to the violence perpetrated in the drug trade. Last year, Gilligan spoke with the business producer Darby Maloney about the parameters, if any, set by AMC and Sony Pictures Television, the studio that produces the show.
There's violence in the show. There's very creative violence, but there can be graphic violence.
Oh, yeah.
Have you gotten notes saying, you know, tone it down, Vince, this is beyond the pale, or, you know, where are they standing on that end of things?
One time we had a throat cutting scene at the beginning of season four. That was, I think, the only time. I mean, we have a broadcast standards department. That's a separate set of notes. That's a separate gentleman at AMC. That's AMC only.
Right.
Who has to, you have to abide by the broadcast standards, which typically means on our show, they're counting the number of curse words.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very sort of Baroque set of rules. There's a couple of words there you could say 4 times per episode, a combination of words you can say 4 times. There's a certain F word that you can't ever say, except once a year we get to use it, except then it has to be dipped. They dip the volume, and we get that once a year. It's kind of
Baroque.
I didn't mean Baroque. Byzantine. What word am I looking for? Anyway, it's complex.
It's archaic.
It's complex. Let me say it's complex.
Do the writers sort of fight over who gets to have that one F word? I want it for my episode.
We do. We don't fight over it per se, but we think long and hard about where to use it.
Sure.
Again, you know what? I have to say, I think it's an oddball rule, because if you're going to dip it, why not just be able to use it? But I think it's an aesthetic decision on AMC's part. They don't want to hear it, you know, all the time. However, when they show Scarface, you're hearing it all the time, dipped. So
mm-hmm.
it kind of, whatever. It's you know, you got to love your family, quirks and all, I suppose. But we get to drop the F-bomb, which we get to show unexpurgated on our Blu-ray and on our DVD. When we choose that moment, we choose it very carefully so that it has maximum effect. You don't want to it's your magic bullet. you want to fire at just the right moment. So, I suppose.
And you were saying that Standards and Practices had some notes on the throat cutting scene.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I tend to digress, don't
That's
I?
Okay.
The throat cutting scene was about the only time that violence that we had a note of violence. We had this was in the final cut version where we were asked to cut about 3 seconds of hemorrhaging, basically when this character got his throat cut, and I was a little annoyed at the time because I was thinking of how gory The Walking Dead is, but the
zombie series,
which
AMC.
Is a great show, but they get away with stuff that I thought, man, this is nothing compared to that show. But they said, well, those are zombies. This is a living human being, and I said, okay, they all look the same to me. I don't know, a zombie and a real guy, but they bleed the same. At any rate, I got on my high horse a little when that note came down. Having said that, you know, watching it in hindsight, I don't miss the 3 seconds. It more than makes its point.
So in the modern TV landscape, there is like a new animal out there called the binge watcher.
Yeah.
Okay. People who, and I admittedly am one of those, who consume episodes of shows one upon another. And Netflix streaming allows this to be possible. iTunes allows this to be possible. There are all these different ways of consuming television other than that first episode run with the commercials in it, et cetera. Mm-hmm. How much are you aware that people binge watch Breaking Bad? And what do you think of that way of consuming it, the story?
I am pleasantly perplexed by it. I am at once very proud that I can hold someone's, or something I've worked on can hold someone's attention that long. And then I think, you know, man, how are you making a living? What's going on there? It's like, you know, but it's just, I heard a story, actually. The first time this ever came into my consciousness, I heard a story, and I can't remember who told it to me, but it was about a woman who was in her final stages of pregnancy, and she had been watching, this was probably back in season two, she had sat down to watch season two on DVR or wherever she was watching it on. She was halfway through the last episode when she went into labor, and she stayed in front of the TV to finish watching in labor. I don't know if that was apocryphal. I don't know if someone was exaggerating the story to me. I love the story, though, and I hope the baby came out fine.
But from a business standpoint, it's interesting. I mean, Netflix has numbers on this, and from what I understand, the number of people who, if they started to watch season one, the amount of people that finished watching the whole season was 73%. Season two, if they start watching it, 81% finished the whole season. Season three, if they started it, 83%. So you can kind of assume, all right, I'm gaining viewers through this different way of getting it, to the point where your season premiere for season five was the highest, the most watched show you've had, right?
It's wonderful.
And
yeah.
I wonder how you think of that as somebody who works in this business. Granted, yeah, you don't think about money stuff, but like, wow, that's a whole new way of people buying into.
Oh, it is indeed. It's yeah, it's wonderful, but I do see the worry. This is a business. It's show business. And if there's no money to be made, these jobs, this wonderful job I have, and jobs just like it are going to dry up. So we should all be interested in how they monetize this stuff. And I think it's wonderful people are binge-watching this show. I say have at it. But I do see the companies, the various, not just ours, but the various companies' concern that if you're binge-watching on a DVR, you're skipping all the commercials. And if the guys who buy the commercials on your air realize that all their commercials are being skipped, they're going to stop buying the commercials. I got to tell you, what I don't want to see happen is a constant crawl. I don't want some bright guy coming up with the idea. And we've already got these awful bugs, they call them. It started off with a station identifier at the bottom of the screen, and now you've got these animated cars driving across the bottom of the screen, and, you know, watch this show next. And, you know, and now they've added sound effects to these awful things, and they are a harbinger of darker things to come, in which, you know, we can't sell commercials anymore, so we'll just give over a quarter of the screen permanently to some commercial for, you know, adult diapers or something. And you'll have to we'll have to reframe the show when we're directing it so that we don't use that quarter of the screen. We don't put anything important up there, because something that is DVR-proof, I fear that that is in the offing. I pray it is not, but you know, it worries me. It should worry all of us. That's how it worries me in an aesthetic and creative sense.
Sure.
Yeah. Because if no one's making money doing this stuff, then we're either going to have some version of that, or just everyone's going to be watching YouTube videos of people's dogs jumping into the pool. You know, we're not going to have shows like this anymore.
Well, Vince Gilligan is the creator and showrunner of the AMC series Breaking Bad, which is now in its fifth season. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Darby. This was fun.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.